and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Market podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, it's the last episode of 2019. So we'll take a trip down memory lane, highlighting the most memorable market moments of the year.
That's right, Sarah. And confession to listeners, we're recording this in advance, so no craziest thing of the week, unfortunately. However, I do believe our guest came prepared with the craziest thing he saw in markets all year. So I already gave my craziest thing in markets for the year last week. So we will focus on our guest then. His name is Matt Perrone. He's the Chief Investment Officer for City National Bank. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right, Matt, we like to tease the audience with what the craziest thing of the year is, so we'll get to that at the end. But talk us through how you saw the year progressing. I mean, boy, it looked like things were dangerous there for a while in the middle of the year. Everybody was worried about a recession. How does, as a strategist and investor, how do you handle a year like this? I mean, was it a tough year to navigate?
You know, it was, in the sense that, we started the year with really a scare. Late December 2018,
right, right.
Was pretty tough on the markets, almost down 20%. So for us, it was a kind of a head scratcher because the fundamental outlook just wasn't that bad. And yet the fear in the market was just, and the fear in our clients, and everyone felt that this was finally the end of this cycle. For us, you know, we had to do our job of hand-holding clients, of telling them really the fundamental outlook isn't that bad. We do think the market's overreacting.
Right. Talk them off the ledge a little
bit. Talk them off the ledge. And there was a lot of that. But and we published a note called There Will Be Growth in the Spring, borrowing from the Peter Sellers, which has some good and bad connotations. But the point to it was that, you know, we did think there would be growth, and finally that came out. And then, of course, we had that mid-year dip that you spoke about.
So talk us through how your client sentiment has changed from then until now. You mentioned, as Mike mentioned, having to talk them off a cliff. Things did get scary in the middle of the year. There was a lot of talk of potential recession, either at the end of this year or heading into 2020. Where do they stand now? Have they really come a long way?
Yeah, they have. I think you've seen a lot of people now more comfortable. There are a lot of cash on the sidelines and clients who have come and said, okay, I see now that this expansion still has some legs to it. Maybe taking some more risk does make sense. You know, with rates being lower, it's pressured a lot of people who have been in cash to say, how do I put my cash to work? And don't put me fully into equities, but put me into, you know, higher yielding securities. So that's been a dynamic for sure. For our typical client, we've stayed invested and we've said that from the beginning. It's time to be cautious and be up in quality, but stay invested.
You know, some notes you sent over, you made a really good point about the multiple expansion in the equity market this year. I mean, that's basically all we got. Very lackluster year for earnings. So now we're looking, I don't know, something like 20 times trailing earnings for the S&P, forward earnings, something a little less than 17, I think, the last time I checked. Does that make you nervous at all? I mean, are we really pricing in a rosy situation for 2020 with that aggressive multiple expansion?
Well, the multiple expansion was certainly farther than we anticipated it would be. I think we'd had just about all of the appreciation in the markets this year came from multiple expansion. The way we frame that out is, you know, it's somewhat textbook. If you look at the impact of rates on the multiple, well, it actually did what it was supposed to do with rates coming down to where they were.
Right.
And you flow that through to either a regression model or a discounted cash flow model with low rates and an equity risk premium of 4% with 4% growth, you get to about today's price. So it's not completely disconnected from reality, but it's an optimistic view that this will continue now for a long time. So one of the stories of 2019, back to your earlier question, we went from real pessimism and fear to now, things are going to be okay for the, you know, foreseeable future.
Right.
I want to get your thoughts on this, talking about multiple expansion and then compared to the E of the PE ratio and how earnings fit into valuations. I was looking at some research recently from Ned Davis Research, and what they found was that in really gangbuster earnings years, typically you don't have great equity returns. And it's because typically those returns are pulled forwards. And we saw that happen in 2017, where we had a great year of earnings last year, but then we really had a great year of returns for the stock market in 2017 ahead of the tax cut. And then this year, we've got a no earnings growth, but at the same time, we've got an unbelievable returns within equities. Do you think it's saying the same thing potentially about earnings for next year, that we've had such great returns this year?
First of all, I agree with that view. It is kind of counterintuitive that you would see appreciation ahead of the market gets in front of it. It does a good job of sniffing out earnings growth ahead of time. So it what we call it pre-trades it, if you will. So yes and no. I think it's seeing a return to earnings growth, but I don't think the market is yet pricing in a big uplift in earnings. By our measure, it's pricing in, 5 or 6% earnings growth next year.
Right. As you said, PEs often are a function of the interest rate environment. Low interest rates, you're willing to pay up for stocks, pay a little higher valuations. Is there a treasury yield that would sort of make you worry that it'll start putting a lid on equity gains, at 3% on the 10-year or something like that?
Yeah, I think you're right. That's where you start to see the yin and yang of higher yields will mean typically higher growth. So you can start pricing that in. But then when you start raising the interest rate input, if you will, that caps the multiple. So they offset each other. I think we're above 4%, I think, is where that starts to get that math, if you will, gets tough. And so then you would see equities struggle a little bit more.
So you say above 4%. I'll say our guest that we had on the show last week, she said she could see the 10-year in the range of 2 to 3% in 2020, but likely staying towards the low end of that range. Do you see it as at all possible in 2020 to get close to 3% on the 10-year and maybe even close to that 4% range?
I think 4% is going to be tough. 3% is possible. Anything in a cyclical could happen. Our base case is more aligned with your guest from last week, that it'll be somewhat capped in that low 2% range. We should get some uplift from a recovery in the manufacturing sector in the non-U.S. Economies, which, by the way, is another big story of 2019, the tale of two economies. And that's another story that I think is going to change in 2020.
Oh, yeah. You think the rest of the world will sort of play a little catch up?
I think so. So if you look at this year and you look at it either in the macro and the micro, right? The macro data, manufacturing was soft. We saw that in the PMIs, et cetera, global PMIs. In the micro data, in the S&P 500, companies with domestic exposure generally had flat to slightly up earnings. And companies with more than 50% of their revenues outside the U.S. had earnings down 10% on average. And that probably has moved through the cycle. That was driven by an inventory cycle. That was driven by the trade dynamic. And both of those were moving through, hopefully, on the trade, moving through the end of that. And if that, even if it doesn't uplift, it'll be the removal of a negative. And you could see a reversion there, and it'll be more balanced in terms of the global outlook.
One thing in your notes I found interesting is you say dividend stocks are cheap. Now, when I hear dividend stocks, I immediately default to thinking utilities, which part of the year they got very, very expensive. Less so now. I think they're back below a multiple of the S&P trading at a discount. Consumer staple stocks got pretty expensive. And then on the other end of the risk spectrum, I look at MLPs, the Master Limited Partnerships, which are cheap as heck, but very risky, obviously. I mean, I think there's several MLPs that not too long ago were at like double-digit dividend yields. So walk us through what dividend stocks you kind of have your eye on right now that look cheap. And not just cheap, but if you're buying a dividend stock, obviously you want that safety. You want to see that dividend keep rising or at least stabilize. So where are you seeing good opportunities there?
First of all, the dividend stocks are relatively attractive.
Right.
They are versus the rest of the market. But it's important to look at them on a sector cross-sectional basis. And what I mean by that is balanced across the sectors. You're right. If you look at it, where are the high dividend yielders? The utilities and the REITs, those and the staples, those have typically been more expensive if you don't balance around the sectors.
Right.
But if you take a balanced view of every sector, technology, energy, as you mentioned, then in general, the dividend stocks by sector there's lots of opportunity in there. So right. We can find opportunities within every sector and create a balanced portfolio around that. But yeah, and then you bring up, you know, some of the energy patch is getting very interesting. Yeah. You see some good yields there. We've been very selective, adding very selectively in that sector as well of late.
Yeah, even financials for a while this year had some really surprisingly strong dividend yields. You know, you figure, you know, with the sort of less of a focus on regulation and Fed stress tests, maybe those will even be sort of stronger growing dividend stocks than you would have guessed a few years ago.
Well, they just trade with the yield curve.
Yeah,
and with the yield curve flat, you know, the algos kick in and, you know, and I think on an unwarranted basis, the algos really, I don't want to blame them too much, but I think,
they don't listen to the show. So
good. So they won't be affected.
It was tick by tick. You know, they were, you know, rates down, financials down.
Yeah.
It was kind of too much lockstep to be anything but.
Right.
But I think, and that misses the dividend story, which is quite strong. And the earnings yield on those is quite impressive. So the capital return story at the banks has been tremendous.
Right.
They're buying back a ton of their own stock. So it really is a total return, total shareholder return story there that I think was missed for a while when the curve was flattening.
So do you think it's a miscommunication or at least a mistake for people to generalize when they think of dividend yielding stocks? A lot of people will just think of your classic bond proxies, the ones that Mike mentioned, real estate, for example. But the idea that you can actually find companies with higher dividends across any sector, you just have to do the work.
Absolutely. I think that's right. I think what happened was you had both a phenomenon. I want yield and I want safe yield. Because the world is ending, right? So utilities and REITs hit that low volatility, high dividend cross-section, if you will. And so people gravitated towards that. And I think they're missing the shareholder yield and the dividend yield available in other sectors more broadly. That's something we focus on as a broadly diversified high dividend strategy.
All right, Matt, I got to say, this is my favorite line in the notes you provided us. Tons of our ultra high net worth clients are calling and saying, I miss this. How do you get me back in with low risk? Now, me being not exactly an ultra high net worth client, but let's pretend I am. How do you get us back in? Do you have to talk these people sort of down from the FOMO effect here?
Yeah, and I don't know if I used the word back. If I did, that was a typo. But I meant to say, how do I get in? Because many people have been sitting out and for years, and they're finally saying, you know, at least I want more yield. Maybe don't put me into the equity markets, but get me some more yield. So we are seeing a lot of calls from clients who really want to participate in at least yield instruments and get out of cash, basically.
Right.
So is this on the equity side, more so on the fixed income side and credit? How would that be?
It's more on the fixed income side and credit. People, it's too far to go from pure cash to equities.
Big jump, so, especially at this point in time.
Yeah. So move me up the credit spectrum in terms of, you know, more yield in the credit dimension. But safe yield is really the question.
It's an interesting thing because when the world seemed like it was, you know, barreling towards a recession earlier in the year, those cash yields were pretty attractive. I think the money market funds were at about 2.25 around there for a while. So a lot of people really parked out there, it sounds like, among your clients.
They did. You know, 2.5 was okay. And then the Fed took that away, right?
Yeah.
And so that's really what's driving that dynamic.
Yeah,
so
forcing them back in.
And I'm curious about the psychology here, because you said it's been years. So I imagine they've been waiting this out, waiting for a good opportunity to get in. And I think back to 2018, and you would have thought you had the S&P down 19.8%, almost the end of the bull market. You would have thought that would have been a good opportunity. Was there just too much fear surrounding 2018 as well that we didn't actually see investors who have been out sitting in cash take that opportunity to get back in? And that means they've then missed 2019 as well.
I think that's right. I think putting aside different client bases, I think when you look at the flow data, a lot of people were continuing to outflow, they have been for a number of years, into bonds. And they continued that even at the bottom of 2018. So, yes, I think a lot of people have missed out on this rally. And now, you know, you're starting to see the flow data reverse a little bit. So they're coming back in.
So if you had to boil it down to sort of a asset allocation decision right now, what would you tell clients? Overweight certain assets, underweight? I mean, are you, it sounds like you're still bullish on equities, but maybe not hyper bullish?
We think it'll be a coupon year in equities, just like you call it in fixed income, where you just collect your coupon, the spread doesn't change. That'll probably be the same thing in equities. You'll collect your earnings growth and your dividend yield, but don't expect another re-rating of the multiple higher for sure.
Yeah.
What we're counseling to clients right now is stay with high quality. It's late in the cycle to really, you know, take risks. So large cap, dividend payers, as I mentioned. And there are cheaper parts of the global markets. We like Asia, for example, especially EM Asia is much cheaper and you have growth. They should be at the bottom of their cycle and you can see some growth. So we like that area on a relative basis, growth versus the value that you're getting there. So there are parts of the equity markets. In the fixed income markets, we like certain areas of emerging markets credit. You get nice spreads with pretty tight covenants there. You don't have as much covenant light as you do in the U.S. Bank loans, we've got spots in bank loans that are good. There are some frothy spots in the corporate credit markets, but certainly areas in the bank loans that we...
I'm kind of chuckling inside because it sounds like the covenant situation is better in emerging markets than it is in...
Well, if you're an emerging markets issuer and you have to issue in the U.S., right, you have to have a pretty tight covenant to get
a higher bar to...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, built up the hype, Mike did at the beginning of the show, your craziest thing all year long. So I figured, why don't we get to it? And then we can also talk a little bit more about it as well. What would you say, 2019, craziest thing that happened?
Well, so I'm going to keep my comments confined to the markets, right? Because if I go into the Twitter sphere or anything like that.
Too many to choose from.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a crazy year all around, I'd say.
There was a lot to choose from in that dimension, but we'll stay with the markets. I think the craziest part was just the panic that of the recession that never came, right? And we really had, I mean, just there was, if you looked at the market, if you were on Mars, you would say, oh my God, there's a major recession or depression coming. We had 2008 pricing in certain cases, yield curve coming, you know, flat, et cetera. That was kind of crazy because it was really disconnected from reality. Sure, there were soft patches in the manufacturing sector, just like in 2016, there was a soft patch in the energy sector. Just like in 2011, you know, it was like a mini cycle, there's no question, as you'll see, but a financial crisis almost was being priced in. That was odd to us.
And I think as a representation of how far we've come, I think it is unbelievable. You had an inversion of the yield curve, these recession fears, and now as we do close out 2019, you now have the steepest yield curve since all the way back in 2018. So it's really come full circle.
Yep, absolutely. So what kind of risks would you sort of put at the top of your list for 2020?
The corporate market, corporate credit markets are something that we're really watching. There's some frothy areas there. We're not seeing a big uptick in defaults, but it's a bit of a coiled spring. Yeah. When it goes, it's going to go fast. So we really want to watch that. We're watching the corporate debt market, and we're looking at every different lens of credit levels, et cetera, for stress.
But Sarah, it's not just the end of the year. I can't believe it. It's the end of another decade. I was born near the beginning of the 1970s decade, so I don't like to see these go by so quickly. They keep going
too quickly
and quicker. But Matt, what was the highlight for you of the whole decade? You know, it clearly was the longest. I forget all the stats. There's a million stats for it, but best decade since the 50s or something like that in equities?
So best decade since the 50s if you look at the Sharpe ratio of the S&P. So steadiest gains to the upside, risk-adjusted returns. But I know, Matt, you also have some other statistics as well.
Well, it was steady. I could see that Sharpe ratio making a lot of sense. I mean, the volatility level was unbelievably low there for a while. making the Sharpe ratio high. But I think it was the first decade with no recession. But in terms of total return, so up 250% this decade, the fourth best decade, 1950s being the best at up 480%. So
I think, quite a way to go.
Yeah, you could put it that way. But it's interesting when you look through history that actually it's only the fourth best decade out there.
That is pretty interesting, yeah.
I guess so. As we start 2020, we're already going to start keeping tabs on the next decade and see how we start off.
Well, we'll have a recession this decade for sure. I think that's...
We'll hold you to that in 2030.
We're going to bring you back. Bring you back
okay.
In 2030.
There we go. You remember you said that.
Well, happy holidays, guys. Thanks so much.
Matt Perrone, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Of course.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reganonymous, and you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.